Welcome to the hashtag Faring Pod. At Faring, people come first. My name is Zoya Mabuto Mogoditwa, and I'm going to be your host for this conversation today. And in this episode, we will be discussing bedwetting, but specifically from the lens of the parents. And we're saying, you know, how do I support my child through bedwetting? I'm joined by three very special people, starting with Dr. Margaret Fokkemer, who is a GP specializing in incontinence. And I'm also joined by two very special people. And I'm saying they're special because we are doing this for the first time. What are we doing for the first time? Well, we usually speak only with doctors, but today we get to hear from those who have lived this experience firsthand. So I'm also joined today by two parents who have agreed to join us to share their experiences. A warm welcome as well to Andrew and Sulette. Thank you very much, everyone. And I'm glad that we're having the conversation this afternoon. So, you know, this is an important and heartfelt conversation. And Dr. Fokkemer, I'm going to come to you shortly to introduce yourself. But I think, you know, we talk about bedwetting. This is something that so many families experience, but often struggle to talk about. And so I just wanted to almost give a shout out to parents who are listening to say, if you're a parent listening in, I want you to know that you are not alone. And I think today's conversation is proof that we are trying to create a space of understanding, support, and certainly also get that expert insight. And so with that, to start the conversation, I want to ask you, Dr. Fokkemer, please to kick us off and maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, tell us about yourself, tell us a little bit about what your occupation entails.
Thank you. I am a general practitioner specializing in incontinence. And the reason why I'm in this specific speciality, which is a subspeciality of urology, is because I had a daughter who was born with spina bifida. And because of that, she had a neurogenic bladder. So it meant that she was incontinent and she couldn't actually empty her bladder normally. And I visited it. Many specialists and people who were perceived to be specialists in this area, and I was not actually getting the help I needed. And my child was actually going into renal failure, and I just thought, this can't happen to a child of mine on my watch. So I decided to study as much as I could about the subject so I could actually help my own child. And through the process, I met various people, and eventually I did find those experts that could actually help me. But I learned a lot in the process, and we got to a point where my daughter's incontinence could be managed completely. And today she's fully functioning. Most people don't even know she has a problem because there was help out there, but there was very little going on in South Africa at that stage. And I had to seek help from people in Europe, in Canada, in the United States. And in the process, people started asking me to see their patients because I'd walked the road with my daughter as a mother and as a doctor. And I realized if I was going to help them, I needed to actually no more. So I went to the United Kingdom. I visited the various clinics there. I did the various courses that were available. I actually was corresponding with people all over the world at that stage. And I then went back and I did a master's in urology. Then I felt, okay, now I'm in a position that I could actually start to help people. And it developed from there. Initially, I was seeing more adults, but as time went on, there were more children. And bedwetting became something that I felt very passionate about because it was such a Cinderella in the realm of medicine. People basically thought it was a psychological condition, and they were unaware that it was actually a condition that could be treated, that had underlying causes. And there was misconception amongst doctors, never mind amongst patients, and people weren't going and getting help. And when you see a child and they're desperate to go on a camp or sleep over, and they're just too scared to because the embarrassment of wetting their beds if they go out. It's really quite devastating, especially when you know you could help them. So in the process, my practice grew on the bedwetting side, and I would say probably about 50% of the kids I see now have bedwetting problems. So it developed from there.
I mean, that introduction, I think, you know, sets the tone.
for the conversation. I think we're in the right hands. That's the first thing I want to say. But I also want to reflect on how, I mean, the power of our personal stories, the power of the experiences that we could, you know, that we go through to steer us in a particular direction. And I'm hearing that, you know, your experience with your daughter contributed to where you find yourself and the specialization. I want to zoom in on, I mean, you speak about how you're quite passionate about this topic, bedwetting. And I think for me, I always say, let's start at the very beginning. Often we hear all of this terminology. When I first did the topic, I heard the word enuresis, and I thought, enu what? And I think sometimes we hear some of this very complicated terminology. So we're talking bedwetting. What is it? Give us a brief explanation of what it is and what causes it.
So mostly bedwetting occurs, obviously, when the children are sleeping at night. But we will sometimes find that when children are sleeping during the daytime, they will also wet themselves. So it's not always just nighttime wetting, but it mostly is. And when we look at the causes, I want to reiterate that when I was a student, we were told bedwetting was psychological. You had to go and check what had happened in the house. Were the parents getting divorced? Were the parents too strict? Was there some kind of problem with the child? You know, there was this, and I can remember patients coming in and the mother would sit there and say, I'm not divorced. I don't hit my child. I'm not angry. She's got a nice teacher. And they would list all the things that they thought caused the bedwetting. But now we know they're in what we call primary enuresis. So that means it's bedwetting. That is, the child's never been dry for longer than 6 months. And in that scenario, we get number one, we get something we call an overactive bladder. So an overactive bladder, if we just think quickly of what a normal bladder does, it fills, and while it's filling, it's sending signals to your brain, and it's telling you how full your bladder is. So if we just think now how full our bladders are, we can get a sense, and then that feeling goes away. And as the bladder fills, those signals become more urgent. When it's time to empty your bladder, your brain switches the bladder on, the bladder contracts, the valve releases, and we have a normal wee. When we have an overactive bladder, the bladder is contracting during the filling phase. So as it contracts, the brain interprets that contraction as a sense of urgency. So we have an urge to go to the toilet, not because our bladder is full, but because our bladder is contracted. So in the daytime, these children will often be going to the toilet quite frequently, and they make their parents quite angry because they say to them, do you need to wee? And they'll say, no. And then 5 seconds later, I have to go this second. And that's classic. And they're not being naughty. They really didn't need to wee 5 seconds ago, but now the bladder contracted and they need to. So what happens then? This bladder is irritable. It's contracting all the time. They have an urge to go. They're going to the toilet frequently. And then while they're asleep, and their bladder contracts, they empty the bladder. And it's quite nice to explain to the children that you aren't bad. You're not naughty. You've got a naughty bladder. It's your bladder that's actually causing this, and take that blame away from them. And then they also have a very small bladder capacity. So if a child should have a bladder capacity of, let's say, 200 mils, and they have a bladder capacity of 50 mils, and they're making 200 mils at night, well, there's going to be a problem. There's going to be an overflow. So that's the one cause. Then the other one is we have a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. It's excreted by our brain, and it goes to the kidneys, and it stimulates the kidneys to keep fluid back. So we make a quarter of our urine at night and three quarters during the daytime. So if there's, for some reason, there's not enough of the hormone, or the kidneys aren't sensitive enough to the hormone, these children make too much urine at night. So now you have a child who's making 200 or 300 mils at night, but their bladder can hold 50 mils. Well, you can see the problem. They're going to empty their bladder. And then the third thing is the inability to wake up at night. So this is where the neurological part of bedwetting comes in. So there's always this conception that bedwetting is something you're just going to grow out of and don't worry about it. But there is a neurological component. And we have dopamine, which is in the brain, and it's supposed to stimulate the areas in the brain that are going to prevent you from emptying your bladder during sleep and wake you up with the feeling of a full bladder. So we should wake up with a full bladder, even if we've got an overactive bladder or if we're overproducing urine. And these children are sleeping through this sensation. So there's a neurological cause, and that's often overlooked. So we can treat the overactive bladder and the overproduction of urine quite easily. But we somehow have to get the bladder and the brain to talk to each other during sleep.
Mm.
And that process takes a little bit longer. So for a child to be dry, they need to concentrate the urine at night. They need a bladder capacity can hold the volume that they are producing at night. And they need to wake up with the feeling of a full bladder.
Mm. Whew, that's...
you go.
I'm looking at the parents. And again, you know, really want to appreciate Andrew and Sudette for joining us. I think that was comprehensive. And I mean, I love the picture you paint. I could see the naughty bladder. And I want to bring the parents in at this point. And really, I think it is about just hearing some of the personal experiences. You've heard the doctor unpack, you know, what bedwetting is. And I could see the both of you sort of umming and ahing because you were going, we know this and we've had the experience. And maybe, Andrew, you can kick us off.
Sure.
You know, when did you first realize that your child might need help with bedwetting?
Sure.
Take us through the experience.
So my son is 8 years old at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And he has always been a very busy, very, very active boy. Loves his sport, loves to move his body. He's not the child that you will find sitting in front of the PlayStation for hours on end or watching TV. He does it, but it's not something – he would much rather be outside playing basketball or soccer or something along those lines. So when he was about 18 months, he very naturally potty trained during the daytime. It was the easiest thing for us to go through. We were very, very blessed, very, very lucky. And we thought, sure, what a win, you know. Teething was one thing and, you know, we thought, oh, potty training is going to be a nightmare. It was not.
Mm.
Came out of the nappies, never had an accident, you know, post-nappy phase, carried on with his life and it was brilliant. And we noticed that the nighttime was continuing, which we thought was normal.
Mm.
And speaking to friends and family, that was really how it progressed.
Mm.
But he did develop asthma. And he went on to chronic asthma medication. He was on asthma pumps that he had to have twice a day, etc. And we had regular visits with his pulmonologist then and the pediatrician. And as he sort of got to the age of 4, we were like, look, I know this is not asthma related, but he still wets his bed at night. We're still not able to take him out of nappies. It was never a dry nappy ever. And she said, sometimes the asthma medication can have an impact on that. Just leave it. Let's see how he grows out of the asthma. And he did grow out of his asthma and he's completely non-asthmatic anymore and carries on like a normal, very sporty child. But the bladder never... You know, he never had a dry night after that. And it was at that point where we still discussed it with the pulmonologist. And she then said to us, go and see Dr. Fukuma, because this is probably not related to his asthma medication. And she would be the best person to take you on this journey. And it was at that point that we went to go see Dr. Fukuma. So for us, it may have been a little bit late. We went to Dr. Fukuma when he was about 7 years old.
Okay.
So we've been there for 8 months now. And, you know, well, we've been working with Dr. Fukuma for 8 months now on this program. And there has been a big change. We're still going through the motions and we do know that, and I think parents need to understand that it's difficult, absolutely. But when you start getting help, it is not going to change overnight. You're not going to receive a pill and the doctor's going to say, here you go, start taking this medication and from tomorrow you're bedwetting free. No, it doesn't work like that. It's 100%. A journey. There's measuring. As Dr. Fukuma said, you know, we talk about the bladder holding 50 mils in some instances, and that was our son. He essentially was holding what a newborn could hold at the age of 7. And there's been a lot of work that went into it, not necessarily just with medication, but with pelvic floor exercises and things like that to strengthen, if I'm saying correctly, the pelvic floor and the bladder and help to retain that. So the wins don't necessarily always mean a dry night. A win is, wow, look how much your bladder was able to hold because you're measuring the urine output. You're measuring, wait, when we started this program, my boy, you were doing 50 mils. Now you're measuring 250 mils, 300 mils. That is great. That is showing that you are able to hold more. So it went from great, you know, this child potty trained so quickly to, oh my goodness, we're sitting here with a 7-year-old that we cannot get to go to a sleepover to, you know, enjoy that sort of life.
Mm.
And he's a social kid. He has all the friends in the world. Mm. He's a sports kid. He wants to do those things. But he also doesn't want to do those things because he knows what the consequences are.
And we're going to unpack all of that. Thank you so much. Mm. We're going to unpack, you know, the impact on the child. We are going to unpack, you know, I mean, you talk about 8 months and you're saying we aren't even, it's still a journey.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about, you know, going through the motions, et cetera, and we'll unpack all of this. But I think what I want to do is I want to bring in Solette into the conversation as well, because she's also sort of nodding, going, yes, me too. And let's hear what her experience has been, and I think we'll unpack as we go along. So Solette, as I bring you in, really, I think for me, it the question is, when did you first realize your child might need help with bedwetting, and how old were they at the time?
My daughter was 5 years at the time. I'm a qualified teacher, and at university we touched on things like this, and they told us you can only start worrying about bedwetting at night at the age of 5. So my son was potty trained in the daytime potty training within 3 days, as well as my daughter. My son was potty trained nighttime within a month, and he had never had a wet night ever. Mm. And then when my daughter arrived and her potty training journey started, she was never dry. Mm. And then I was like concerned about it because the daytime potty training went like this.
Mm.
I didn't worry too much about it because I knew she had to be 5 for you to be able to go to a healthcare provider. And it was at that stage when she turned 5, and it was for another concern that I went to the pediatrician. I spoke to him about it, and then he said, well, you waited until exactly the right stage, because if you came earlier, I would have told you just wait until she's 5. And then he prescribed some medication, and we realized it didn't work at that stage, and then he referred me to Dr. Fokuma as well.
And maybe just to link to what Andrew had said, how long have you been on the journey with Dr. Fokuma?
It's about a year and a half, almost 2 years.
Okay. And yeah. And what are you seeing?
We are completely dry.
Oh, yay.
It's been like 3 months or so. Is it 3 months? More than 3 months? Yeah, completely dry.
Whew, we're getting excited at the beginning, and perhaps we need to almost sort of keep that for the end. I didn't realize that we'd gotten to the place where we are completely dry.
Yeah.
But I think I sat with the question around what's your process and your journey been. I want to come back to a couple of things, you know, Andrew, that you said. The first of those being that, you know, the reality is that our son is active. This is a child who's active, quite social in terms of how you describe him, and then he has to deal with the reality of you know, still being someone who wets their bed. I don't even know what the right terminology is, but you know, he still wets his bed, and he's aware of it.
Yeah.
You know, so at some point they were small enough to not be aware, and then at some point they become aware, correct, and it starts to have an impact. I want you to unpack what. Even experiencing and watching that must feel like for a parent when you don't even know kind of where to go. Dr. Fokuma says, you know, when she was experiencing some of her challenges, she said the biggest frustration was that she could not find appropriate help, didn't know where to go. And so what was that experience for you? And I'm directing the question at the both of you.
Sure. I think, you know, when we started this journey, and when I say, I can't say started this journey, but before the journey with Dr. Fokuma, you know, we had friends and family. My brother has a little boy, same age as my son. So it was nice to sort of bounce ideas off each other and be like, oh, we're going through potty training. How's the teething? How's the diet and the food and all of that sort of thing? And when we got to a point where my nephew was sort of going off and carrying on without nappies at night, and my son had to keep wearing nappies at night, we're like, okay, cool, we'll watch this for a bit. And I think the challenge was sometimes they would go for a sleepover to Nana's house, you know, to the grandparents' house. And he would see, oh no, but my cousin doesn't have to put on a nappy anymore. My cousin's not having to, you know, do these things. He's not having a wet night. What is going on? And there he would then start asking the questions.
Mm.
And we would say, sometimes my boy, it just takes a little bit longer for other kids. You know, mm. don't worry, you know, these things will happen. And we started to say, we're going to help you with this. In hindsight, after meeting with Dr. Fukuma, realizing that maybe it wasn't the best approach, but we didn't know any better, would be like, okay, I'm going to get up with you every night. And we would set our alarms at midnight and at 2 a.m. or whatever it was. Get up, wake him up, shame, take him to the bathroom, make him go to the toilet in his half asleep state.
Sure.
And try and do that sort of training and do that for a little while and see if that worked. And it just didn't.
Of course. You know,
it just didn't, because it was a physiological issue.
Hmm.
It wasn't the fact that he was not developing psychologically properly, or there was anything else that was wrong. His bladder could not hold more than what it could hold.
And so, of course, at the time, you didn't know this.
No.
You had no clue what was going on. And you did what you thought was. And I'm sure, I mean, you would have turned even to the Googles, talked to other parents, etc.
Yeah, it just didn't happen. You know?
Can I come in a second? It's one of the most common treatment options that parents use.
Mm.
It seems to be out there that that's the way to go. And why we don't like people lifting their kids is you're actually teaching the bladder that it's normal to go and wee at night. And you shouldn't. You should be able to sleep through the night. So you're actually creating a problem by the treatment that you're choosing to try and help your child with.
Wait. So parents typically would want to, as a means to sort of, I don't know, address the issue,
yes,
would want to pick the child up and take them
to the toilet,
to the loo, so they can pass the urine. And you're saying that's not how we should approach this.
No, we shouldn't do that at all.
And you're saying this is because, and I'm just wanting to understand. Mm. And you're saying this is because,
parents believe that if they pick the child up before they've wet and take them to the toilet and have a wee, then they're going to be dry tomorrow morning.
Uh-huh.
And then they've cured the bed wetting. But the minute they stop doing that, they're just back to square one. Uh-huh. So that there's no curative effect,
okay,
in actually lifting your child during sleep. And okay, half the time they're asleep. They don't even know. They sort of put onto the toilet, correct, and sort of wee and go back to bed, and they didn't even know they had this.
So it's unsustainable.
Yes,
it's because not. It means that your sleep as the parent is interrupted for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Yes.
But you're not actually, you know, curing or actually remedying the problem itself.
Yes.
Wow.
Even in my case, where I actually knew that you're not allowed to, you shouldn't pick them up, or you shouldn't do that, I was so desperate. It was just maybe before she turned five. I was like, come on, turn five already so that I can just go to the doctor, you know? I also picked her up, but just like before we would go to bed, let's say at 10 or so. And that didn't help at all.
Mm.
And then she wouldn't even know I picked her up. And then I even tried the cold turkey way to try and help her to wake up when she gets wet. Ach, man, and she didn't. She would wake up in the wintertime from the cold bed because she didn't.
What's
even
– cold turkey wear?
Cold turkey, like take off the nappy, take off – like let her sleep in her pajamas without a nappy.
Oh, I see. Okay.
To help her body to realize, oh, gosh, I'm wet, or I'm getting wet. You know that warm feeling that you sometimes get? I was hoping she would wake up from that, and she didn't. She slept right through it.
Yeah.
And I just realized, oh, if she can just turn five, so that I can just get to somebody, that will help me. Because if I'm not mistaken, if you get to a doctor too early, they would say, no, wait, because the hormone or whatever will kick in by a certain age. And if you don't wait long enough, then you're actually wasting your time. So, you know, that's why I tried so much. Oh, she would hate it. She doesn't sleep over at all. She'll sleep over at grandma and grandpa, but they knew about it. And the enuresis that was there present with her. So, but she realized her friends didn't use a nappy.
Yeah.
She's clever enough to know it. I don't know if they speak about it when they're having a play date or whatever, but she knew it, and she was so embarrassed about it, and she just wanted to get dry.
Mm. I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm watching you because it almost feels like you are reliving some of the experience and the frustration. Yes. I can see it in your face. I can hear it in your voice. Mm. And maybe let's just talk a little bit about that. It can be incredibly frustrating. I'm thinking about somebody who's listening, who's currently going through it, who says, Sulet, I am you right now. Mm. I want to tear my hair out. I don't know what to do. It's so stressful. Let's talk a little bit about the impact on the parent. You know, what was the impact on you? And I suppose what were some of the ways in which you tried to get yourself to a good place so that you could be good for your baby?
So I first have to tell you about my personality. And Dr. Fokker would absolutely agree. I'm 100% kind of person, even a 200% kind of person. I don't do something halfway. I do it because I feel like then you're wasting your time. If you do it half-heartedly, you're never going to get anywhere. You have to just do it.
Mm.
And I was so frustrated because you try this, and even my pediatrician even prescribed medication, and it still didn't work.
Mm.
And after a while, when I saw him again, he doubled the dose. And after 3 weeks, I said, I think we had like 2 dry nights. He says, no. You had to have 3 wet nights in this time.
Mm.
And then he said, no, go see Dr. Fokker.
And so it is. I mean, it is frustrating. Mm. It is incredibly frustrating for parents. And I think, I mean, and I go back to you, Andrew. Mm. As I was listening to you, you seemed very calm. I thought, wow, Andrew definitely had this under control. He seemed incredibly calm through this. And you know, he was able to give the reassurance to your boy, etc. What did you do to keep so calm?
So look, it hasn't always been that way. I've learned that the process is there for a reason.
Mm.
And it doesn't help to put your anxiety onto your child at all.
Mm.
Not to say that you don't feel that level of anxiety, mm. because I definitely agree with Sulet. There is a hell of a lot of that
mm.
when it comes to dealing with wet beds and wet nappies every single day.
Mm.
And then you will go through a period of 3 weeks where it's completely dry and nothing's happened. And you
sure.
think, wonderful, we've turned a corner. Well, then you get smacked by the next corner. As you turn the next corner,
sure.
you get smacked in the face. And there you get a month full of straight up wet nights, you know. So it's gotten to the point where you've got to just trust the process and mm. work through the process and follow the steps, you know, so that it becomes quite a habit for you to know that, okay, we need to measure. And I know we'll get to those things.
Mm. Sure,
measuring
sure.
output, measuring things. But yes, the frustration, nice glass of red wine after bedtime.
Oh, you know? Absolutely.
You know, but yeah, you can't let that anxiety. Your child is already very anxious about it and very embarrassed and knows exactly what's happening. So you've just got to not pass that on to them as well.
I am a very anxious person to start with, but I tried not to show her it. But when she's so disappointed every single morning when she wakes up and it's wet, it's hard.
It is hard. It is hard.
And you try to stay calm and everything, but your heart's breaking for your child.
Yeah.
So I mean, I love what we say, though, about how there is an actual process.
Mm.
There's a process, and I think I want to unpack that or get into that. And how I want to get into that is really through understanding what was your first point of contact when seeking treatment. And then I think we're going to get into, you know, where you eventually were able to find, you know, this angel dressed up as a doctor.
Mm.
Dr. Fokker, who has, you know, really been instrumental in this process, in this journey for yourselves. But what was your first point of contact when you were seeking treatment?
Mm.
Was it about going straight to a specialist? Did you start with a pediatrician or some family doctor? What was that?
I went to our pediatrician. My daughter was ill. She, I think she had gastro or something. I can't remember.
Mm.
And then I just mentioned to him about it. And then he prescribed medication. And about 2 weeks later, I don't know if it's about that long, but she was hospitalized because of the gas or whatever. She was dehydrated. And then when he did his hospital rounds, I told him, by the way, we're still wet. And then he doubled the medication.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we were discharged from hospital, he wanted to see her again because we come a long way with that pediatrician of ours. And he's got a very soft spot for my daughter. And then he said he wanted to see her again in about 2 weeks or so because she's a very tiny little girl, tiny for her age, and she he was scared that she might have lost too much weight, so he just wanted to check up on her. And then he asked me about how's the medication working, and then that's when I said, no, it's not working at all. And then he referred us to Dr. Fokuma.
Okay. Mm. So you were referred to the specialist sort of soon after by the family pediatrician. Yeah. Okay. And yourself, Andrew?
Yeah, similar sort of story. Our son had asthma, as I had mentioned, and we had mentioned it to our pulmonologist. She actually was his pediatrician and then specialized in pulmonology, and we were on this journey with her, and she treated his asthma. And when we started saying to her, look, he's five, he's six, you know, we're still dealing with the bedwetting issue, her feeling was that it may be related to the asthma medication. And when he grew out of the asthma and we still weren't seeing any improvement, she recommended that we get in touch with Dr. Fukuma, which is exactly straight away. I was like, anything, please. You know, I didn't actually know a Dr. Fukuma existed in the world, you know, that specialized in this sort of thing. So when I found that out, it was the best news.
Me too.
And yeah, we were straight there and got an appointment as soon as we could.
Dr. Fukuma. And maybe before we kind of go into the journey or we explore the journey a little bit more, I want to come back to you. And the question I want to ask you is, you know, we have some people listening who are currently experiencing it, who are going, do I take my child to a pediatrician? Do I go straight to the specialist? How does one make that decision? What determines, you know, when I need to actually now be going for that specialist, you know, help?
So different cultures have different feelings about bedwetting. Some people feel that you should already take your child when they're 4 years old. But traditionally, we've always said five is a good age because when you're treating bedwetting, you want the input from the child as well. Because as they say, there's journey. And if there's no input from the child, if the child absolutely doesn't care.
Or understand.
Yes, it's quite hard to actually get them to cooperate with things that you want them to do. And from five onwards, children can actually understand and work with you. But there's a good sort of idea to actually go, and if you're worried, take your child to your GP. Let them just check and make sure that there's nothing wrong with the child physically, that you're 100% sure this child is fine, because a child with primary enuresis mustn't have other underlying diseases. So we have to make sure there's not something else that's going on, and your GP or even your pediatrician could examine the child and tell you, okay, don't worry, your child's physically fine, but they do have this condition. And then I would say from the age of five onwards, it's a good time to actually start seeking help if your child's still wet.
And a little bit later, we'll talk to where they can actually seek this help. A lot of what I'm hearing, even in this conversation, you know, are the two parents saying to me, I didn't even know there was a Dr. Fokuma in existence until my GP referred you. So I think it would be important for us to be able to guide our listeners to where they could find this information. But I want to come back to our parents. And in coming back to our parents, I want to talk a little bit about what were some of the most effective things that helped in your child's bedwetting treatment journey. So if we're talking treatment now, so you're in this process, you're on this journey, what were those you know, effective things that you had to do? Maybe it was a lifestyle change. Maybe it was, what did you need to do?
Well, the very, very clear guidelines from Dr. Fokuma and Dr. Grandal, that's what helped me absolutely. And like I said, I'm a very to the point person and do exactly what I'm told. Otherwise, I'm wasting my time. So, and then of course, my absolute diligence and strict way of applying rules and guidelines every single day with no room for breaking any of these rules. Those rules were also something that helped my child and myself through this journey.
What were some of those rules? And again, I'm going to ask the question, are the rules the same for everybody? Are the rules slightly different, you know, to speak to the specific need? What were some of the rules?
Well, the rules, I would say, is cut out sugar, cut out dairy, cut out, like, change the diet absolutely, completely. I mean, I packed two different lunch boxes for my kids because my son could have anything. And well, I'm not a kind of mom who, I'm one of those horrible parents that forgets to give my children treats. But see, I don't put in snackies and like sweet stuff.
Wait. Yeah. So let's backtrack a little bit. So you referred to Dr.
Grandal.
Oh, you were referred to Dr. Grindel?
Yes.
Okay.
I was referred to Dr. Fokema. I just said I saw her as well, because basically there was everything wrong with my kids. She had an irritated bladder. She had a small bladder. She didn't wake up at night when she had to go. She was constipated. And she had a very tight pelvic floor. And Dr. Grindel actually helped with the pelvic floor. So Dr. Grindel, I saw Dr. Fokema, and she said, take this out of the diet, take this out of the diet, this. Not too much salt, not sugar at all. And then I went to see Dr. Grindel, and she gave us exercises to do, to loosen, to relax the pelvic floor.
And maybe the reason I was pausing you is because I'm latching onto something Dr. Fokema said about how this journey is not, it's not you, the parent, imposing, you know, what you've been told to do by the doctor on them. My understanding is that this is a journey, and this child needs to be enrolled in the journey as well. So that by the time you're introducing all these changes, the diet change, lifestyle change, you've got to do this, you can't do that anymore, there's a willingness on their part to participate. So what was that process? Because I imagine that happens prior to introducing all those changes.
Well, Dr. Fokema spoke to my child in such a wonderful way. She explained to her what exactly is wrong and what we need to start doing from now on. And that's so my daughter understood and I understood, and then we had to make it happen. And my daughter was all in it. Is that what
you
wanted?
I think that's important. Yeah. I think it's critical because, I mean, I've heard of situations where a child wets their bed, they have no idea what's happening, and parents get quite irritable. And I've known situations where parents beat up children because they go, there's something wrong with you. It's your fault. How many times have I told you? You've got to wake up, etc. Yeah. And I think just listening to that compassionate approach is so important. And I think it can even be encouraging in terms of saying to parents, if you engage your child in compassionate ways about this thing that they don't know what to do, how to solve or what to do anything about, that's a big first step.
Yeah, you see, and it's not the child, people, you can't beat your child when they are wetting the bed. It's not being naughty. I mean, nobody will wet their bed on purpose.
No,
it's like breaking the door on purpose or the glass. They'll never do it on purpose. The harsh way isn't the way. You have to do it with them, like in a team effort.
Like we would discuss it with family and friends. And, you know, some of our lovely family who we adore would say, well, make him wash the bed sheets.
Yes.
You know, make him feel like, you know, he doesn't need, so that he knows not to do that again. You know, watch him. It's going to break your heart, but make him do the cleaning. Make him do the washing. Make him wash all his clothes that he's wetted. And we've never done that. And I would never, ever, ever, ever do that. But those were some of the, you know, advice. Misconceptions and advice
and
that you gave.
It doesn't make one a bad parent. I think it just makes one a parent who doesn't have the information.
Correct.
And you're operating from a place of ignorance and frustration, because
Absolutely.
To wash sheets every single day is onerous.
Yeah,
it is tedious. You don't want to be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that first part, and then I think we move to, then you get very practical things
Correct.
That need to be done. So the first I heard related to diet.
Yes.
So changes in diet, and maybe Andrew share additional things that needed to change, strategies that you needed to adopt to assist your child to get to a better place.
So a lot of it did initially come down to the diet. And you know, you need to learn that there are going to be certain things that trigger your child. We were chatting before the podcast about certain colorants, you know, that may be triggering for the bladder. For us, it's always, you know, he's going to go to a birthday party, and I'm not going to say to him, you cannot have the sweets, you cannot have the cake, you cannot have the, but I just sort of go, remember what's going to happen later on, you know, and he knows those things. He's mature enough to understand. And we have to sort of sometimes let those little things go. But for the most part, it's having a healthy, balanced diet. So yes, we're packing lunch and we're packing the right fruits and vegetables and no sugars. He used to have Milo for breakfast in the morning. Well, he hasn't had that since we started seeing Dr. Fokema. But he has rooibos tea, and he's very happy with that. So it's all good. You know, he understands the bigger picture. There's also a lot of the process is measuring what your output is in the morning. How much is your bladder holding? So what is your morning weed? Let's have a look. Oh, daddy, look, I managed 250 mils.
Oh,
daddy, look, I did this. And that has to become part of the routine for everyone, not just the parent going, come quickly, we in the cup so we can see what's going on. You know, he needed to become part of that process, which has helped a lot. And now sometimes it becomes a little joke. He'll call me from his bed, go, daddy, I'm wet. Oh, I've wet the whole bed. And then I'll go, okay, my boy. And he goes, I'm joking. Dry night. And
oh,
I'll go, okay,
my.
There we go. Well done. You know, so bringing them that on that journey as well, so that he's not anxious to wake up every morning and see what the outcome is. You know, we're not going to reprimand you. We're not going to make you feel lesser, you know. You're on a journey, and every little day there is a little bit of growth. And some days you might feel like you're falling back, but look at the picture. And Dr. Fukuma gives you a nice chart where you color in all the dry nights, and, you know, and then you say, but look at this. Look how many dark spots there are. Look how many blocks you've colored in. That's how far you've come versus when we started. You know, you had no dry nights. So, yes, it's the diet. Yes, it's the routine. And making it not feel onerous so that you can get to the end of the road eventually, yeah.
I mean, I love some of these strategies. And I think for me, it's because it removes some of the stigma, the stigma, the shame, the humiliation. And it really makes it, you know, this journey that we're on together or as a family. And maybe my curiosity now is, you know, how do you manage it in the context of siblings and other family members? Because I can imagine that this affects the whole family.
Yeah. So my son is an only child.
Okay.
So he's lucky in that sense. But like I said, there are cousins and you know, close family that they like to spend time with and that he likes to spend time with. And, you know, my mother and my father, his grandparents, are very well aware of it. And so when there is a sleepover with cousins and things like that, they do know how to approach it very nicely. And he will still share the bed with his cousins and sneak off, like I said, to go and slip on his pull-up if he feels like he needs to. And he's a bit worried about not wearing it and wetting the bed when he's sharing the bed with his cousins. He's got his little strategy. And, you know, my mom is like a little, hey, remember, we got to do this now, you know. And, oh, yeah, thanks so much. I'll go and sort myself out. So, you know, that's how we play it with the family at the moment, Charles.
Thank you.
In my case, my son was very helpful. I explained after our first visit at Dr. Fukuma, I explained to my husband and my son both what's happening now and what we're going to start doing from now on. And I explained to my boy that, like, the whole naughty bladder situation. He's 4 years older than her, so he understood completely. And he would actually help me a lot to say, Mama, she's going to drink a fizzy drink now, or daddy's going to give her a piece of chocolate now. So he would.
He was deputy parent.
Yes, he was. So he was such a champ. He really helped. And especially, my daughter don't do sleepovers. She's too young for that. That's how I feel. But she sleep over at grandparents only. And they were well aware of the situation. And then he would remind them, no, she's only allowed one or whatever.
And I imagine that you had to do some educating of the grandparents and obviously the siblings,
yes,
etc. But there is this almost sort of work that you have to do to assist the grandparents, the aunts, you know, siblings, etc., to also understand what's happening here, so that they're empowered, you know, to join you on this journey and to give you support.
Well, it's very difficult, though.
Why? Why do you say that?
Oh, you know what?
What is difficult?
Difficult to educate older people.
Yes.
Because, you see, the older generation does not understand that almost everything that you put into your mouth has got sugar in it. Almost everything. And And also, they like to treat their grandchildren to sweeties.
Yeah. Of course.
I mean, my mom.
And this is where I was going with this, yes. Right? You take them to Nana, and all Nana wants to do is to give them sweeties.
Yes. And it's so hard. And you know how hard it is, especially when Andrew was saying that at parties and so on. Because I can't tell my child she can't have her party back.
Mm.
But she was so good. And especially when my boy was also there, he would say, Ontona, remember now, only one or two, and then mommy will give you tomorrow another two or so.
Mm.
But grandparents like to treat their kids with sweeties. I mean, sometimes when my mom comes to visit, they don't even say hello. They'll say, where's the sweeties? Where's the sweeties? Then I say, oh, no sweeties until you say hello. Mm. You know, and also when they do sleep over at the other grandparents, they also like to treat them with other things. And there's so much sugar in there. And I had to ask my son and also my daughter to you can choose one. You can choose one. And that was hard on her, but at least it worked after a long while.
Okay. So I think it is important, though, to assist them with the awareness and to really Absolutely. Enroll them in the journey, because it is a journey and it requires everyone. I want to talk a little bit about, and this is something that came up in a previous conversation about this topic, that there is often a link even in terms of like genetics. So, and I remember it was, you know, a conversation to say, one should also ask the question, is there a history of bedwetting in our family? And I want to come back to you, Dr. Forkema, because I really want us to unpack this a little bit. You know, how does genetics play a role at all?
Bedwetting is genetic. It is hereditary. They have found various foci on different chromosomes that code for bedwetting. So it runs in families. And if both parents wet the bed as kids, we see that up to 70% or more of those children will have a 70% chance actually of being wet. If one parent, it's probably about 34%. And even with neither parents knowing about a parent or somebody in their family, there's still about a 17 to 20% chance that the child will wet. So, I mean, overactive bladders run in families. Mm. We particularly see that the overproduction of urine definitely has a genetic base. So, yes, it definitely does. And when you sit with these kids and you ask that question, is there anybody in your family who has a bedwetting problem? And then sometimes the mother or father will say, well, I had, or my mother had, or my uncle or my brother. And the kids will sort of like turn to their parents and say, what? We didn't know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then I say to the kid, it's your mother or your father's fault.
And again, I think this is important, you know, because if we don't have the information, it's easy, I think, to go, something is wrong with my child. And we know that, you know, just that approach can have an impact psychologically in terms of this child and, you know, and how they present. And I'm being generic here, but I think it is important that we continue to build this awareness. And so I want to ask a question about awareness building. And I'm linking it to the fact that you said when you had your experience with your daughter, and similar, you know, our parents said when they had the experience with their children, they didn't know where to go. So to parents who are listening, who are saying, I'm experiencing this right now, where do we point them? You know, where can they go to learn a little bit more? And maybe not from Google. Because yes. Google, for all of its, you know, there's really good things about Google, but sometimes I think Google can have the opposite effect and take people down a downward spiral.
Absolutely. No, it does.
So where do we direct the parents who are listening, saying, I am going through the most, I want to pull my hair out, I am anxious, I am stressed, it's a lot. Where do they go to get that sort of reassurance that there is help out there and you know, they can get that help?
Well, hopefully their GP or their pediatrician should be able to guide them. But a lot of people don't actually specialize in this area. And that makes it really hard because, as I say, it's a Cinderella part of medicine. And it's something that's not talked about. Parents don't talk about it. Children don't want people to know about it. So it's not something that's shared within a community. So I sort of feel if you go to somebody and you are being helped and you feel that they are actually making a difference, be it your GP or your pediatrician, then you're in the right space.
Mm.
But if you see somebody and they brush you off, or if they just give you some medication and there's been no progress, then please look further.
Mm.
There will be somebody who will have a little bit more information or a little bit more knowledge, or they would be able to point you to the right person.
Mm.
And I think that's really hard on parents, because I find that within the medical fraternity, we're still educating people. And especially in the sort of older generation, I mean, we were brought up that it was a psychological thing. So that sort of sticks. And I also think your GP often doesn't have enough time.
Mm.
I spend an hour with my first consultation with my patients. So I can actually get all that information and explain to the parents, explain to the children, because I find that if they don't understand what's going on, they're not going to follow what we want them to do.
Sure.
And your GP has got 10 or 15 minutes with you, so they quickly seeing you and, okay, try this, and if it doesn't help, then we'll look at it. So just try and seek out that person who's going to have a little bit more of an interest. And there are doctors out there that do have an interest in bedwetting and in helping patients. Mm. So don't start looking. If you're not comfortable, if you feel you're not getting the help, then please look further till you find somebody who actually is going to be able to help you.
And medically, what's the term for the specialist who addresses this specifically? You specialize in incontinence.
Yes, there's unfortunately not a specific speciality. So I've sort of super specialized in that area. But your pediatrician should be able to guide you. Your GP should be able to guide you. And ask your GP, if you say, listen, I'm not getting the answers, I'm not getting better, isn't there somebody else that you can refer me to?
Mm.
Urologists are also doctors that deal in this. But once again, they often are looking more at the surgical point of view.
Mm.
There are urologists that have a special interest in bedwetting and do really good work in that. And so I would say your pediatrician, a urologist, or a general practitioner would probably be the people that you should be able to find help from.
Mm. And maybe to bring it back then to the parents, thank you so much, Dr. Fokema. Let's come back to the parents and maybe just say, you know, what would you offer to parents who are listening, having, you know, had the experience firsthand as well?
You can go and read up on, you can, like you said, Google can be your best friend, but can also give you nightmares.
A good sentence in one.
Yeah. ignore, you know, sometimes the internet research will throw out the most horrendous statistics.
Mm.
And you think to yourself, well, I've stuffed this up royally. I'm never going to get my child dry. You know, if he's six, they're saying by the age of six, if they're still not dry, then there's an 80% chance that they're never going to come right. Mm. You know, and it's just the most horrendous, you know, statistics that you find. So yes, you do need to read about it. Yes, you do need to find out some information, but try ignore the scary stuff and speak to someone that's a professional, because they will calm you down, you know. They will bring you down to earth and help you understand that there is a plan and a doable process to follow. Mm. And you can see, like I said, sometimes a win is not necessarily a dry night.
Mm.
A win is achieving a full bladder in the morning that has, you know, like grown five times in size since when you started the journey, you know, going from a 50 mil to a 250 mil, you know, bladder capacity. Those are some of the wins. Take the small wins and make sure your child understands those as wins as well, so that they also know what the progress is. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's very important because I think it manages the expectation.
Yes.
I go to Dr. Fokema and I'm saying, Dr. Fokema, you know, by a week or by 2 weeks, I want this to go. And I think it is important that we're quite honest and open about the fact that it is a journey and the milestones present in very different ways.
And like you say, be open to medication.
Yes.
Because that is a big part of the process as well. And understand that the medication is not going to change overnight either. You know, now Dr. Fokema has, we've gone through a month of measuring and strength exercises, etc. Now we're going to start with the medication. It's not going to change overnight either. Mm. You will see a gradual improvement, but it's not going to happen overnight. And just be patient with the process. You've gone this long with dealing with bedwetting. So just be patient to go through a little bit longer with it as well.
Yeah. And I think that's beautiful.
Mm. You know, there's beautiful no quick fix.
There's no quick fix, mm. but it is a journey. And Andrew says it's a patience game. Mm.
What I've got to say to the other to other parents listening, going through the same thing, is just do exactly what the doctor says. Do the exercises, change the diet, drink the water, cut the sugar, fill in the forms. Just do it. Be strict and do not slack. Otherwise, you'll end up doing for this much longer than you were going to do it in the first place. Just to give you an example of the effort that I put in to get this right in the shortest time ever. So I had to complete that intake form and like to say how much water, tea, whatever she takes in. And then when she needs to go to the bathroom, measure and say how much came out.
Because so you're measuring how much she's drinking. Yes.
And then when she needs to go to the bathroom, I had to say like five times, that's how we had to grow the bladder, because she had everything, small bladder, constipation, irritated bladder, and the inability to wake up at night, and then the pelvic floor. But now we had to fill in that form to take it to the doctor. And you need to fill it in when you are with your child from she's waking up until she falls asleep, because you can't do it when she's at school because the teacher won't measure. And so I used to do that on a Saturday and a Sunday, because that's when I'm with her all the time, as close as possible to the next appointment of your doctor. And that specific day, when I think the appointment was on Tuesday, whatever. So the Saturday and Sunday before that, I had to fill in this form. And on that day, my husband decided that that is a day for the theme park. I took the book and the form and the pen and the measuring cup in my handbag to the theme park. And then obviously there was fizzy drinks and all those things. And I just wrote there, because she didn't drink as much water because we are at a theme park. I can't refuse her any sweetie stuff or whatever. And then she said, I had to go up to go to the bathroom. And then we are there. Then we ran to the bathroom and I took the pen and the book and the everything. And I checked how much. And I even took one of those carton paper rolls from kitchen just to put in the cup after I rinsed it out, because otherwise my handbag would be a problem. But I just did it. I was diligent and I persevered. And Dr. Fokomo and Dr. Grindel were laughing. Did you actually take it
with you? She
I did. I did. And I'm just trying to emphasize on the fact that that's how invested you need to be in this whole process. Mm.
She's the dream mother, by the way.
And I suppose if you're listening on the other side and you're thinking, so what do I take from that? Don't go to the theme park.
Don't go. You see, Sean, my husband works horrible hours. He says, get in the car, we get in, because that's the time we get to spend
with
him.
So, yeah. Of course. But I think, I mean, more than that, it really is about you were diligent. Mm. You really said, I'm committed. I understand what needs to be done and I'm going to be committed. And I think the results then show. Mm. And so maybe just to come back, or stay with you rather, not come back. Let's stay with you a little bit, because you said, you know, in our journey, we're starting to see really positive results. Where are we now?
Yeah, we are at, I think it's almost 4 months that we are dry, completely dry. Not one night, one wet night. Not, she's not wearing nappies, but that's for a while now. And completely dry.
I got like
dry.
A little goosebump thing.
And we are actually getting off the medication now. Mm. So there were three types. Of the first one, I weaned off like Dr. Fokomar has prescribed. The second one, we are almost completely off. And I think there's about 3 or so weeks left. And then the last one, I'm actually seeing you next week, and then she's gonna, Dr. Fokomar's gonna tell us how and when we should actually go off the last part. But yeah, we are almost there.
Your hard work has paid off, and I think I want to just acknowledge you.
Thank you.
And all your hard work. And I think it can serve as encouragement again. You know, maybe there's another parent who's listening who's already on the journey going, oh, there's so many things that need to change, and this is just like never gonna end. And just listening to you say that there has been, you know, a positive response. There has been like light at the end of that tunnel, to use that metaphor. So thank you so much for sharing, you know, that part of your journey. I'm hearing, you know, talking about medication. So at some point we spoke about how there are the sort of changes to diet. There's lifestyle changes, diet changes, etc. And then I think Andrew, you threw in something about medication, and now Suletta as well. You're talking about medication, Dr. Forkema. Just help me to understand that.
Yes.
When does medication become a part of the journey?
So we first start with the behavioral and the sort of changes in diets and drinking more fluid, etc., treating the constipation. But when you have an overactive bladder, sometimes that's not enough. Mm. And then we need to give medication that's actually going to relax the bladder. And there are different medications that work on the bladder in different areas. So some of the medication actually blocks the receptor that makes the bladder contract, and other medication relaxes the bladder. And sometimes we find that if we only use the one, we're sort of getting there, but not quite. We're sort of 70-80%, and we need to get to that 100%. And then we use that in combination. So when we're treating the patient, we've talked a lot about the measuring, but if you start with a bladder capacity of 50 mils, the journey to increase that bladder capacity to a normal capacity for that child's age can be quite a long, very difficult pathway that we have to go along. Mm. And in that time, I say to the parents, forget about the dry nights. The increase in the bladder capacity is success. We've got to actually see that this child has increased his bladder capacity from 50 to 250. And that's a major, major achievement. Yeah. And the child needs to realize, look how well I've done. Even though I'm not dry, I've still increased my bladder capacity. So we will give medication there, and we will adjust the medication. And when I see them, we measure the bladder wall thickness. So when they've got a very irritable bladder, when you exercise a muscle, we always say that bladder's in the gym, nice thick muscle. And as the bladder stretches and the muscle's not so irritable anymore, the bladder wall actually thins. So we can actually see the progress on the ultrasound. We can see the progress on the increase. And that's why the measuring is so important, because it's showing us we actually are achieving that success. And people forget, you know, they'll sit there and I'll say, oh, there's been no improvement. And you say, well, 300 mils versus 20, 30, 40 mils, major achievement. And then suddenly people have hope again because they've seen that. And then we have the overproduction of urine at night. So we have medication that can help decrease the amount of urine that's being produced at night.
Mm.
But it doesn't help giving that medication when we have a bladder capacity of 50 mils.
Yes.
Yes, you're going to be less wet, but you're not going to be dry. Mm. So we're aiming for the dry.
Mm.
So once we've got a bladder capacity where we know that if we decrease the amount of urine that's being produced and we add that medication, then the potential for dry nights is huge. And then we start to see the success. And there's nothing more amazing than when a child walks in through the door and they say, I'm dry.
Yes. Yes.
It's so amazing. And you see how their confidence increases. You see how they're just suddenly this happy child, because now there's not this dark cloud hanging over them anymore.
Mm.
So we do use medication. So it's mostly medication to relax the bladder and prevent it from contracting, and medication to decrease the amount of urine being produced. And sometimes we need medication for constipation as well, because constipation is a huge contributor to bedwetting. And if we don't address that, then we find that the children aren't progressing. We're still getting wet nights. And why? So it's actually a whole... We have to look at the whole pelvic area. We have to look at the bowel. We have to look at the bladder. We have to look at the pelvic floor. We find a lot of children that have very tight pelvic floors.
Mm.
And if you think you've got muscles and you've got nerves coming through the muscles, so if they're in spasm, they're going to be pinching the nerves.
Mm.
So they're going to be irritating the bladder because the nerves are irritated. And then we're going to not get those symptoms to relieve. So when we get to the point where the child's dry and we start to take medication away again, we want those good habits to already be there. We want a nice big bladder capacity. We want the children drinking enough fluid. We want the constipation to be something that they've forgotten about.
Mm.
And so that we know when they're off the medication, they're going to be fine.
Mm.
There are children that relapse,
mm.
and we have to be aware of that fact. But at least we now know that worked for you.
Mm.
We just go and do that immediately again, and then we get back on the bus. Yes.
And I was almost curious about that. Again, thinking through the fact that we've got an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. And
she's 7 now.
Oh, she's 7 now. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So an 8-year-old and a 7-year-old. And, you know, we get to the point where, you know, we've come to the end of the journey because the child is now dry and they're excited going, I'm dry. And then they go back to the habits. And I'm thinking about something as silly as I go back to drinking a fizzy drink.
Yeah.
Mm. And I wonder whether that could trigger a relapse.
It can. I've got a few children that, even though we've got them completely dry, we can't get them off medication completely because they have very irritable bladders. But in this journey, we learn what our bladder irritants are. Not everything on the long list that we give you initially is a bladder irritant for you.
Mm.
So you find out what yours are, and then you know. And then the children experiment. They say, okay, if I have it at lunchtime, am I fine? And then a lot of them are. If I have it at supper time, not so much.
Mm.
So let's avoid this at supper time. But I can have it at breakfast. I can have it at lunch. I've got one little boy. He was amazing. He found 5 irritants. And when you listen to them, he came down and he sat down and he said, okay, these are my bladder irritants, and it's Nutella and chocolate milkshake. I can drink vanilla milkshake. Orange juice, not so much. So I'm off orange juice. And then knickknacks, because that very orange colorant in the knickknacks was a huge problem for him.
Oh, wow.
And then he said to me, and I always think this was really good. He said, you know what? It was really, really hard for me to stop eating and drinking these things because I really loved them. And tomato sauce was his utmost favorite. And he said, I can't eat tomato sauce. So I have now made peace with the fact that I'm allergic. And if I tell people I'm allergic to tomato sauce, they say, oh, shame, it's terrible, and they don't put it on my food. But if I say it irritates my bladder, then they don't believe me.
Yes.
Mm. So he said when he made peace with the fact that there were 5 irritants that he needed to avoid, he was fine.
Mm.
But he first had to go and make peace with that.
Mm.
And he was 10 years old when he actually had all these irritants perfectly mapped out. And he just says, you know what? I know if I have orange juice, I'm going to have a wet night. So it's just not worth it.
Mm.
Mm.
And I think that's what we need to get to. He can have apple juice. He can have vanilla ice cream. He can have vanilla milkshake, but not a chocolate one.
Mm.
So, you know, it's sometimes getting to that point where, you know, I mean, I've had kids that you know, all children love sweets. But this, he was also a boy. He said, I'm completely dry unless I eat a whole big packet of jelly tots. So if he has a small packet, he's fine. Mm. But when he eats one of those huge packets, he's guaranteed a wet night.
Mm.
So he says, I have to weigh it up. If I'm going to eat so many sweets that I'm going to be wet, then I have to wear something.
Mm.
But if I just do it in moderation, I'm fine. So, you know, we experiment, and it's nothing is forever. But we all have something that we know. Mm. If we have that cup of coffee, maybe we're going to need the loo sooner.
Mm. Mm. I love that I'm laughing a lot more than I thought I would when I was thinking about the topic that we're going to be discussing today. And I think for me, it talks to yourself and just your commitment and passion to this work. It talks to the commitment and dedication of parents who say we invest ourselves and we're going to listen to what the doctor says. And we move from what could be such a depressing topic to laughing about stories where children have become not just aware, but also, what's the word? They've become so almost empowered, you know, about the choices that they're making as it relates to themselves and their health. And I think for me, that's just, I never expected that coming into this conversation. And I really want to attribute it to my guests today. Mm-hmm. We could go on and on and on and on, but of course we don't want to do that. And I think for me, a parting shot could be, you know, if you could go back and tell yourself something at the start of this journey. So if you think about the journey that you've been on, and you had the opportunity just to go back and to whisper something quietly to yourself about this journey you're about to go on, that's daunting, that's uncertain, that's scary, that's frustrating, that's annoying, what would that be?
Be patient.
Okay.
And make it a routine.
Uh-huh.
And then it's fine.
Okay.
It's not as bad as you think it is.
Okay. And so patience still stands out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So be patient and make it a routine.
Yeah.
Definitely. Love that. Thank you. Close us off, Zulet.
I wouldn't really say something to myself because, I mean, maybe say not to be so hard on myself, but I wouldn't have been here where I am today in the shortest amount of time with my daughter, obviously helping me through it. And I mean, she's working wonderfully. Just to get back to the stresses. Because I'm far further in this process than Andrew is. And when we started to introduce some of the food back into her diet, I'm so glad it wasn't dairy. I'm so glad it wasn't tomatoes, because we have a lot of tomatoes in our house. We actually realized that green colorant is her stressor.
Oh.
And she can have a little small piece of milk tart and chocolate cake and one block of chocolate or whatever. I also quite early in the morning rather, but green when she, and I realized that after she was at the grandparents, and she said she had jelly, and then I gave her just a little bit of green milkshake.
Mm.
And that night there was a problem. And then I realized, I asked her what color was the jelly?
Mm.
And then she said green. And then I realized it's green. So she doesn't have any green cold drink, any green jelly, any green sweeties. And she's so good with this now. She takes out all the green, sweeties and give it to her brother, and she's, I'm not allowed, give me some of your red ones.
Yes.
And
it's become fun.
Yes.
And it's integrated into her life.
The only thing I would tell myself is just keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
And I think that's solid and sound. And so I want to acknowledge the parents one more time. Thank you so much. I think it's incredibly brave that you decided to come share the stories. But I think most importantly, it's very generous because you're sharing so wholeheartedly, you know, the experiences that you've had. And I know that this will assist somebody who's listening to the conversation. So I want to acknowledge Andrew and Zulet.
Thank you so much
for your time.
Thank you.
And then to close us out, Dr. Fokema. I said the doctor who's the angel who's disguised as a doctor, because I just listened to the stories. And what parting words would you share with us today?
I would love people to seek help and to not give up. The most important thing, and believe in yourselves, because parents know when there's a problem, and don't take no for an answer. Go and find that help.
Mm.
Thank you. And thank you to you.
You're most welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Great conversation. So with that, thank you so much to all of you once more. And of course, I mean, to those who are listening, I think we have not just spoken about what bedwetting is and what the experiences of our parents have been. I think we also have spoken about what you can do. You know, if you're sitting today and going, what is the next step? You've been empowered through today's conversation to know exactly what you need to do. You're not alone, and you need not be alone. There is help out there. Thank you so much once more.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the hashtag Faring Pod. Join the conversation by following us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube under Faring South Africa. Have you been diagnosed with IBD? Download the Faring IBD Health Diary app today. The Faring IBD Health Diary app is available on the Apple App Store and the Android Google Play Store.